everybody. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And because you're here, your Saturday is off to like a rockin' good start. Anyway, this week, we're going to be talking about a chimney problem. In fact, it's the chimney problem that results in the biggest repair bills and the most damage. And surprisingly, it's got pretty much nothing to do with fire. Nothing to do with fire at all. We're going to get to that so that you can make sure that your chimney's not in the danger zone. All right. We're also going to be talking about ghost stories. Got to love that, right? Ghost stories. My voice broke horribly there. We're not going to be talking about legit, well, not completely about legit ghost stories. We're going to be talking about the house-related kind of ghost stories. I'm being a little bit figurative, a little bit cute with my language here. We're going to be digging into the old, outdated systems that still haunt older homes. See what I'm doing? Ghost stories there. We'll talk about those old systems, those outdated systems that we can find in older homes, and what you should do, if anything, when you run into them. You know, you're looking for houses, trying to find the right house. You find this cute old house, outdated systems inside. What do you do? Do you run away? Do you invest a ton of money in fixing it? We'll talk about all of that coming up. But right now, let's go to my inbox, because last week I received a great question from a listener, a really, really good question, and there's a ton to dig into. It's a five-star question. And before I get into answering it, I should stop for a second and say that if you've got a paint question or a design question or anything like that, email me at radio@repcolite.com or direct message RepcoLite on Facebook or Instagram and ask away. If I use your question on the show, I'll send you a coupon for a free gallon of Benjamin Moore or RepcoLite paint, which is what I'm doing for this particular listener. And I'm not giving out any names. I have not given out any addresses. We haven't made fun of anybody. So there is no fear in asking your question. Ask your question. It's all upside. You know, I'll get you your answer. And maybe if I use your question on air, you'll get free stuff. And everybody loves free stuff. Anyway, here's the question that I received. Quote, we are working on a house and we think somebody painted over wallpaper glue. Any ideas how to remove that or at least make it smooth? All right, let's start with the problem and what's exactly going on here. When people strip wallpaper from their walls, you know, everybody hates this job anyway. So we try to get through it as fast as we can, right? And we normally skimp and cut corners here just because we're so sick of it. You know, we would rather do anything than strip wallpaper. I'd rather clean. Well, I'm not going to go into that because it's early in the morning and some people are eating breakfast. But a lot of us would rather do anything on earth than strip wallpaper. So when we do strip wallpaper, we tend to cut corners a little bit. We skimp. We want to be done quicker than we should be. And sometimes we don't get all of the wallpaper paste off the walls. Now, the walls look good or can look good. They can look clean. They can feel good when they dry after you remove the paper. And a lot of people think and hope and just knock on wood and figure they're good to go. And they go ahead and roll their latex paint on. But here's the big but. Wallpaper paste is water soluble and any residue that's left behind can be reactivated by the water in the water-based paint. Now, it's not necessarily going to be every single time reactivated, but it can be. And often when this happens, it can result in a texturing that occurs in your finished paint. It can also result in a patchy or uneven sheen, you know, in the finish of your paint. And there are other issues that can happen. Now, sometimes people see that it's happening right away and they freak out and they stop painting until they figure out what's going on. Sometimes they don't notice, you know, they just finish the room and they notice it later. Sometimes they notice and they just don't care. Right? They don't care. They're moving. It's going to be somebody else's problem to deal with. Anyway, when the paint dries, often you've got this texturing problem or sheen problem or whatever that's pretty much locked into the surface. Now, sometimes it's way worse than other times. I had one customer years back who had stripped a wallpaper border off the wall, you know, just a wallpaper border at chair rail height. They didn't get all the paste off and they called the store wondering why in the world there was this weird texture all around the newly painted room right where the border had been. You know, that one was really obvious. Now, sometimes it's less than that. Sometimes it's, you know, just in a few areas on the wall. But either way, when it happens, it's absolutely no fun. And it's something that can dramatically affect the look of your finished paint job, you know, especially where you've got this real bumpy area exactly where a wallpaper border had been, right at chair rail height. You can't really move on from that. So that's what causes the problem, and that's what the problem looks like. That's what the listener is dealing with. But what do you do with it now, you know, now that there's paint on it and the paint's dry? Well, sadly, there's only one really, you know, valid solution at this point, and that's to sand that texture smooth. You know, it's necessary, and nothing else is going to make that area blend back in. So depending on how heavy that texture is, you could start with a 120 grit, maybe a 150 grit paper, and start sanding it down. You're trying to knock down all the rough spots, and then once you've got the bulk of that sanded, move to a 180 or a 220 grit to smooth it all out a little bit. Now, if you've got a larger area, you know, not just a few spots, but a big area that you're covering, you know, you're probably going to want to consider investing in a drywall sanding head. You know, there are some that are handheld. You know, you attach your sandpaper to them, and it gives you this nice flat sanding surface with a handle to hold on to, like a big sanding block with a handle. That works really well. If you've got bigger areas, you know, full walls, go get a drywall sander head that will attach to an extension pole. It's going to dramatically speed up that sanding process, and you can get a little more oomph on it. You know, oomph, that's a technical term. We use that in the paint world. When we're talking about sanding, you want to have oomph on it. So the extension pole is going to help you do that. Now, once you've got everything sanded and you've got the dust wiped off with a damp rag, you know, you got to get that dust off, then you're not ready to paint yet. You've got to prime those areas to lock down any remaining paste. Now, if you don't do this, there's the possibility, and sometimes it's a really good possibility, that any remaining wallpaper paste residue will again be reactivated when you put your paint down. And the problem's just going to repeat. And the last thing on earth that you want to do after stripping wallpaper, painting your wall, sanding your walls smooth again, and then painting them again is to have to sand them once again, right? You'll just leave the house at that point. So you've got to make sure that you fixed the problem entirely. And to do that, to lock that wallpaper paste residue, any that might be remaining, to lock it down, there are a couple different options. The first, the old school method, is to use an Elkid primer, like Repcolite's ProFlow primer or Benjamin Moore's Fresh Start Oil Primer. Now, these are the best options if the paste was heavy or if you want absolutely zero risk. You know, water-activated paste isn't going to be activated by an oil-based primer. It's going to seal it in, lock it down, and then you can top coat those oil-based primers with a water-based paint, no problem. You know, there's no water and oil problem when you're talking about an oil-based primer. Go ahead with your water-based paint over top. So lock it down with an oil primer. That's the surefire silver bullet way to go. A second option is a water-based option, and it's a product called Guards, G-A-R-D-Z. Guards. It's probably how the word should be spelled, but G-A-R-D-Z. It's a product from Zinsser. We carry it, and it's designed for trouble surfaces. And one of those trouble surfaces is locking down wallpaper paste residue. Now, even though this product is water-based, it's specifically formulated not to reactivate the paste. Either of those options will work, the oil-based primers or Guards. Either one will lock it down. Now, once you've got the surface sealed and the primer's dry, then you can top coat with your wall paint of choice, and you move on with life from there. Now, the last thing I'll say about all of this today is this. If you want to avoid this problem in the first place, be really diligent when you strip wallpaper and work really hard to remove all of that paste residue. You know, once you think you have all of it off, a really good test is to lightly mist some areas of your wall with water and then run your hand over those spots. If it still feels slimy or slippery, there's paste residue there that you've got to still get off. So keep cleaning. No matter what, you know, even if it feels clean, you know, when you do that little water test, I'd always recommend using either of those two primer options that I mentioned earlier if you're going to be painting that area. That extra priming step, you know, even if you think you did it really well and you got it really clean, that extra priming step can save you a ton of headache down the road. Okay, most of us love a good ghost story. There's just something really fun about them. And usually it's the setting that makes them work. You know, old houses, creaky floors, strange sounds, histories we don't fully understand. Well, let's talk about some of those old houses and the ghost stories that they really come with. Not the supernatural kind, though those are really fun, but the outdated systems that are still lurking in the walls, hiding under the floors, haunting the place. When you or someone in your family walks into an older home and stumbles across these remnants of the past, what in the world do you do? Do you run? Do you figure you're going to have to just drop a ton of money to get the house up to speed? What do you do? We'll get into all of that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. You know, people often think of paint as just another line item on the project supply list. But here's the thing. Everything you do, every hour of prep, every stroke of the brush, all comes down to the quality of the paint. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. And we're back. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And right now, I want to jump into something that I don't think I've ever shared on the show. My ghost experience. Now, I know I said at the end of last segment that we're not going to dig into the whole ghost story thing from a supernatural point of view, but that's not entirely true because I do want to dig into that a little bit just because it's really, really fun and it makes the rest of this palatable. I mean, it's always brilliant. Everything that falls from my mouth is brilliant. Ugh. I know it's not. I just tell myself that so I can get through the day. But this ghost story stuff makes it a little more interesting. Now, I'm not a big ghost person. I want to say that right up front. So don't send me letters telling me it's all false. You know, I don't want letters or emails saying that. And don't send me letters the other way, you know, inviting me to ghost hunter outings or things like that. I know there are things out there that I don't understand. Oh, my goodness. There are so many things out there that I don't understand. But I don't get all spooky and buy into the stuff really, really very, very quickly. All right. So with that out of the way, all of this happened that I'm going to relate. All of these things happened at my first house over the course of about a single week. And it happened about 24 years ago or so. Now, the house was old when we were living there. It was built in the early 1900s in Zealand, you know, 1910, 19 something like that. I don't remember. It was a great little house. You know, it really didn't harbor all kinds of spooky surprises for 99% of the time we were there, until the point when I renovated the upstairs. Now, the first thing that made me wonder if something weird was going on was in regards to the silverware drawer. You know, shortly after completing that upstairs renovation, I got up one morning to get ready for work and I opened the drawer. You know, I want a spoon for my Captain Crunch, right? The crunch stuff needs to be consumed. I need my spoon to do that. I can't just shovel it into my mouth with my hands. Well, I can, but I've been told that that's not proper. So I needed a spoon. I open up the silverware drawer, and that drawer, it had wooden dividers built into it for spoons, forks, knives, and then it had a front compartment that ran side to side, you know, across the drawer for all the weird odds and ends, you know, grapefruit spoons, paring knives, those little nubbly, pokey things that you hold corn on the cob with. You know, all of that went in that weird little front compartment. Anyway, that front compartment, when I opened it up, was full of all of our silverware. All of the other compartments, they were empty. Now, my wife and I, we were the only ones in the house at that point who could reach the silverware drawer, you know, or pull it open. We had two kids back then, but they were babies. They were twins. And while Hanson children, you know, they are at the forefront of society and everything, they're still babies. They even being Hanson babies, they were incapable of opening drawers and moving silverware around. So it wasn't them. Clearly, it wasn't them. In the end, my wife and I kind of decided jokingly that maybe one of us was sleepwalking and did it, right? Okay. We didn't think much about it until a few days later when I came home from work and the silverware drawer was all messed up again. Trying to eat my Captain Crunch and the silverware drawer is messed up again because Captain Crunch isn't just a breakfast food. It's a little pick-me-up in the middle of the day too. Anyway, the silverware drawer is all messed up. Same thing. It's really weird at that point to me. I put it right, and I'm kind of thinking about it. So I get the vacuum out. You know, I've got other cleaning to do, other things to do. So I'm cleaning and thinking about the silverware drawer thing. And as I'm vacuuming the carpets, and this is really tough to describe on the radio. When I tell this story in person, I can show people what I was doing. But picture this. I'm in the middle of the room, and I'm pushing the vacuum forward, right? I walk behind it and push it forward, and then I pull it back all the way, you know, to the other side of the room. It's not the best vacuuming technique. I was a rookie at that point. I've developed my skills since then. But at that point, that's how I did it. I'd push it all the way to one end and then pull it all the way back to the other side. And when I'm walking back to the other side, I'm looking backwards. I'm looking where I'm walking. And the vacuum's kind of in front of me, behind, you know what I'm saying? I can't see the vacuum at that point because I'm looking the other direction. That's the point. Anyway, I did that once, did that twice. On the third time, I'm in the middle of the room, walking back. All of a sudden, the vacuum, like, snags something or something. It lurches in the air, like 3 to 4 inches, and slams back down to the carpet. Like I said, I wasn't looking at it, so I didn't know what happened, but I assumed from the feeling, the tug on it and all of that, I assumed that one of the attachment tubes had fallen loose and had kind of jammed into the carpet and kind of caused the vacuum to jump up in the air and fall down. Anyway, when I looked at the vacuum and tried to figure out what happened, all of the attachments are on the vacuum. Everything is in place where it should be, and there's nothing anywhere in the room. I'm in the middle of the room. There is nothing, not even carpet fibers that I could have snagged. Everything is fine. I have no idea to this day what caused the vacuum to jump 3 inches in the air and slam back down to the floor. No idea. I can't explain it. So all of that was weird, right? But I still put it out of my mind until a couple days later when my mother-in-law came to see the upstairs room. You know, she wanted to see the work I had done. So I was outside when she pulled in. I was getting ready to mow the yard. She walked into the house telling me she was going to go check out that room. And I went to work mowing the yard. And I can still picture it. I was on the front yard mowing, and I looked up and I saw her looking out of that upstairs window in that renovated room. And I waved because I'm, you know, inherently and always friendly. I waved and she just kind of stared at me, didn't wave back. I assumed, you know, she was dissing me. Now, really, I assumed that she was just looking in another direction. You know, I couldn't see her face clearly or see where she was looking specifically. I could just see that she was there. So I assumed she was looking in another direction. Anyway, I wrapped up the mowing and I headed into the house. I found her in the living room holding one of the babies. And I asked her, how did that room look? You know, I wanted the praise. I wanted all of that. I was eager to be told what an amazing job I had done. And of course, she responded, you know where she's, where I'm going with this, because you're way ahead of me. She responded by saying she hadn't even gone up to the space yet and was just getting ready to do so. Well, I completely figured they were messing with me, you know, her and my wife. But they were adamant. They stuck to their guns. They had never left this room. She walked in, went straight to the chair, picked up a baby, and they sat there until the moment when I walked in, and then she went upstairs. She had never gone up there, she said. Well, I was dead sure I'd seen somebody, and with all the weird stuff that had happened that week, I began to wonder if something even weirder was going on at my house. Well, the last thing that happened during that really, really memorable week happened to my wife. We had a small bathroom in that house, and it had no lock on the door. So I installed this tiny little flimsy sliding lock on it so people could have some semblance of privacy. You know, I was the only one who really used it. My wife was never really one for locked doors or the need for privacy. But for me, privacy was paramount. So I put that little lock on there. And during that week, at the end of that weird week, my wife went through about 3 days straight of being locked in that bathroom every single time she went in. She didn't lock it. The door locked on her. She never saw it lock, and she swore she wasn't doing the locking, and no matter what we tried, we could not make it happen on its own. It never happened to me, but every time she'd go in there, or many times that she'd go in there during that end of that week, she'd find that door locked on her, that little sliding bolt, you know, set in place. So, a lot of crazy stuff in that old house. You know, who knows what was going on? Maybe we were imagining things. That's possible. Maybe the previous owners weren't thrilled with my renovation choices or my color choices or whatever. Either way, it made for a really memorable week. So what's the paint point, the home improvement point? Well, rather than talk further about the mysterious and the supernatural, let's talk about a more practical, aka boring type of haunting that's going on in many older homes. And I'm referring to old, out-of-date systems hiding behind the walls and in the floors of our old houses. And if you think I'm making a leap here, I am. I really wanted to talk about ghost stories, and this was the best way I could think to make that legit and still, you know, pay my bills and do my due diligence by talking about home improvement stuff. All right, I've got a friend that within the last few years or so fell in love with a 1920s bungalow house. The woodwork, the built-ins, the character, everything in the house was perfect. But then he and his wife went through the house and started spotting some of these spirits from the past that were haunting this perfect little house. Knob and tube wiring, cast iron plumbing, an old octopus furnace, just to name a few. And they ended up trying to do a ton of research in a quick way to figure out what all of that meant. you know, and whether or not they could or should move on the house or keep looking. So today, I want to break down some common old house systems that you might encounter, what they mean for your home, and when you actually need to worry about them. And whether you're house hunting or not, these are really interesting systems. I keep saying it's boring. It's not boring at all. They're interesting systems, and knowing about them, it's really going to make you seem that much smarter when your kids start house hunting, or your grandkids, or when people at a party ask about an octopus furnace. What's that? You're going to know. All right. So let's start with the electrical system, because really, this is usually that first blast from the past that scares buyers. And I want to talk specifically about knob and tube wiring. Now, knob and tube, it was the standard wiring method from the late 1800s or so through the 1930s and even into the early 40s. Now, in some parts of the country, you'll still see bits of it in homes built well into the 50s. So if you're looking at anything built before 1950, there's a real chance that you'll run into, you know, knob and tube wiring. And it gets its name from the ceramic tubes that the wires ran through and the ceramic knobs that held everything in place. And here's something a lot of people don't expect. For its time, it was actually a really well-designed system. You know, the wide spacing kept the wires cool. The porcelain components, they don't deteriorate. And the copper conductors, they can last a long, 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 long time. And here's a part that really surprises people. Knob and tube wiring is not inherently dangerous. Old copper doesn't wear out just because it's old. The problems that we encounter with knob and tube wiring comes from three basic things. First off, there's no ground wire. And that means you can't safely use three-prong appliances, and there's no protection if a fault occurs. And while the National Electrical Code, the NEC, doesn't specifically ban old knob and tube wiring from existing in a house, it does prohibit ungrounded wiring in kitchens, bathrooms, and other wet areas. So if you find active knob and tube wiring serving those spaces, it's automatically not cool. It's automatically not up to modern standards. So that's the first thing. Second, knob and tube was never intended. Of course, it was never intended for today's electrical loads. Right? We're asking a system designed for a couple of lights and maybe a radio, you know, the talking box. We're asking that system to handle microwaves, air conditioners, computers, TVs, and everything else we plug in. It's just not suited for that kind of heavy lifting. Third, and this is usually the big one, insulation. You know, knob and tube wiring was designed to sit out in the open air so it could release heat. The moment you bury it in blown-in insulation, you can trap that heat, and that creates a fire hazard. Now, for that reason, the National Electric Code, the NEC, generally doesn't allow insulation over active knob and tube, and most local jurisdictions follow that rule. Now, a few Western states, California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, they've carved out really specific exceptions to the rule, but they require, you know, special inspections and contractor certifications and all of that to get around it or to fill in or to make those exceptions fly. For most of the country, though, the bottom line is pretty simple. If you want to insulate your home, the knob and tube usually has to be replaced. Now, another thing to keep in mind, many older homes have been partially rewired over the years. You know, you might have modern wiring in the kitchen and the bathrooms, but original knob and tube still running to other areas. Now, when old and new systems are connected improperly, which does happen, unfortunately, it can create additional hazards. So with all of that said, if you find knob and tube in a house that you're considering, you need to just start by having it thoroughly evaluated by an electrician who understands older systems. And that inspection is really, really important, especially before you start any renovation work of any kind. If the wiring is original, if it's unmodified, in good shape, it's in open, dry areas, it could easily be safe to live with for now. But if you want to insulate your home, and most homeowners eventually do, or if any of the wiring happens to run through damp locations or anything like that, replacement usually becomes the safest and the most practical option. Now, rewiring a home typically runs anywhere from $12,000 to $36,000, depending on the size and the access. So it's a major project, but again, it's often necessary because many insurance companies just won't cover homes with active knob and tube wiring, or they require, you know, really strict conditions, you know, like a licensed electrician's certification that it's safe, maybe an agreement to replace the system within a specific time frame. Some insurers, they're only going to offer coverage if a small portion of the home still has knob and tube. The availability of insurance varies by carrier and by state, so you need to do your research there. You know, I can't make a sweeping generalization for all the insurance companies out there, but the bottom line is that knob and tube wiring can significantly complicate getting homeowners insurance. I think we can say it safely that way. It makes it more complicated, so you're going to want to dig into that. All right, that's one little goodie that can be haunting an old home. Now let's talk about plumbing. And in this case, there are two older systems that you need to understand, cast iron and galvanized steel. Now, cast iron, that was used for drain, waste, and vent lines from the late 1800s, through the 1970s. It's incredibly durable. Many systems last, 80 to 100 years or more, but it does corrode from both the inside and the outside. Inside, sewage, gotta love that sewage, produces hydrogen sulfide gas, which turns into sulfuric acid, and that slowly can eat away at the metal. Now, outside, soil conditions, especially acidic or moist soils, can attack the pipe over time, and eventually that iron, is going to rust through. Now, common signs of a failing cast iron system include sewer odors in the home. What's that smell? Sure does smell like the sewer. Boy, that's a tip-off that maybe the cast iron system is failing. So sewer odors in the home, that's a big tip-off. Slow drains, backups, gurgling sounds, wet spots in the yard. Now, if you've got rust-colored water in your sink, that's usually pointing to old galvanized supply lines, not cast iron drains. But rust flakes around floor drains and deteriorated cleanouts, all of those things can indicate trouble. If you're seeing any of this, it's time for a plumber to run a camera inspection and let you know exactly where you're at. Now, the good news in all of that is that modern pipe relining methods, we've talked about these on the show probably a year or two ago. I'll dig that up and put a link in the show notes. But modern pipe relining methods can sometimes extend the life of cast iron without tearing everything up. A resin liner can be inserted into the pipe and cured in place, and that gives you a smooth new interior. It's way less invasive than a full replacement. But if the pipe is severely deteriorated, a complete replacement may be unavoidable, and that usually runs, anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000, depending on the house. Galvanized steel pipes. So we just covered cast iron systems. Now let's talk about galvanized steel pipes. They're different. They were used for freshwater supply lines, the water coming into the home from the 20s through the 1960s. And basically what these are steel pipes coated with zinc. Now the idea was really, really good. But over time, that zinc wears away and the steel begins to rust from the inside out. Now, galvanized pipes, they've got a lifespan of probably about 40 to 50 years or so, sometimes less in areas with harder mineral-heavy water. So if your home was built before 1960 and the original plumbing is still in place, those pipes are kind of beyond their expected lifespan. So I love just dishing out great news on a Saturday morning or whenever you catch this show. But that is the reality. And there are some warning signs you can look for. Low water pressure, especially on the hot water side. Brown or rusty water from the taps. Visible rust at the pipe joints. Leaks. A leak is always a sign that something's not right. I don't know what's going on, but that leak tells me something's not right. The tricky thing with galvanized is that it can look perfectly fine from the outside while being almost completely, clogged, let's say, on the inside. I've seen water supply lines reduced to the diameter of a pencil, but outside they look fine. Replacing all of these things, again, really hard to give numbers to this, but it could cost anywhere from $8,000 to $20,000 for a typical house, depending on size, number of stories, whether it's on a slab or has a basement. Modern options are copper or PEX tubing. PEX is now probably the most common because it's faster, it's cheaper, it's more forgiving if water freezes in the lines, all of that. Here's one important note before we move on. Some insurance companies won't insure homes with active galvanized plumbing, or they'll charge significantly higher premiums. So replacing those pipes often isn't a comfort upgrade, it's a requirement. All right. There's a couple different things haunting our homes. Let's move on and talk about one more. a little ghost that's lurking, and I want to talk about gravity furnaces. And these are massive cast iron systems that were installed from the late 1800s through the 1950s, and they're commonly called octopus furnaces because of the great big huge tentacle-like ducts spreading out from the center. They're like monsters that live in your basement. They're nightmare fuel if you're a small child. And unlike modern forced air systems, these older systems, these gravity furnaces, they rely entirely on natural convection. You know, hot air rises, cold air falls. And because of that, they're usually only about, 50% efficient. You know, don't get all hung up on that. But that seems to be the general easiest way to state that, about 50% efficient. You know, so in practical terms, what I'm getting at is you burn a lot more fuel for the same amount of heat that you get from a more efficient system. You also can't add central air conditioning to a gravity system. There's simply no blower to push air across an AC coil or move it through the house. You know, the system wasn't designed for it, so central air just isn't an option until the furnace and the ductwork are replaced. And on top of that, many of these old furnaces and their ducts were originally wrapped in asbestos insulation. You know, now that doesn't automatically mean danger and that you should freak out, but it does mean that you can't just tear these things out by yourself. So if you find one of these furnaces still in operation in your home, assume that it's nearing the end of its useful life. You know, replacement for one, especially once you factor in asbestos abatement and new ductwork, typically that replacement's going to run anywhere between $8,000 and $15,000. But that is just, for starters. It depends on how things shake out, how things go, how big the house is. It could go higher. You know, you could be in the $20,000 range. You just need to get those quotes. That's not what I'm here for. I'm trying to give you a ballpark to help you decide if it's time to run away or if it's something you can budget for. Anyway, if you're looking at an older home, wrapping everything up, and we've got a lot of beautiful historic housing here. If you're looking at an older home, get a thorough home inspection. It's a really good argument for why that's important. But also, beyond just that inspection, consider bringing in specialists. You know, a home inspector, they're going to give you this big picture overview. But an electrician who understands knob and tube wiring, a plumber who can run a camera through your drains, and an HVAC tech who's actually worked on those old octopus furnaces, those folks are going to be able to give you specific, actionable information that's going to help you decide and make better plans regarding what is your next step and what you should be doing, moving forward with that particular house. Now, don't let any of this really scare you away from a house that you love. Older homes are incredible. They're often better built in many key ways, and they've got character that you can't recreate. And they're in established neighborhoods with mature trees and a real history. So a lot going for these older homes. Just go in with your eyes open, know what you're buying, understand what may need attention, and plan accordingly. All right, let's shift gears. What do you think causes the most damage to chimneys? It's actually not fire-related at all. We'll talk about what it is and, most importantly, what you can do to prevent it right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Think about it. You spend hours prepping, sanding, taping, and then finally painting. Don't throw all that work away with an inferior product. The paint isn't just another supply. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. And we're back. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about the roof leak that I had up near my chimney. And like all home projects, the more I dug in, the more I learned. And one thing I didn't talk about in that segment, but I really should have, was the chimney itself. You know, there are something like, 40 million, I think was the number I ran across, 40 million masonry chimneys in North America. And the most common problem that they deal with is water, not fire, not critters, but water. So what's the deal with that? Why in the world is water such a big problem for chimneys? Well, first off, brick and mortar themselves are basically like sponges. You know, every time it rains, they soak up water. And then in Michigan, we've got our freeze-thaw cycles that turn that moisture that's in the brick and in the mortar, turns it into cracks, crumbling mortar, and spalling brick. So right off the bat, you've got, just the very nature of the bricks and the mortar themselves make water an issue. Second, you've got the chimney crown, that slab at the top that should be concrete. It should be sloped and it should be overhanging the brick to get the water away from the brick. But many crowns are just thin mortar. They're cracked, they're flat, or they're flush with the chimney. So that water ends up running straight down the side and right back in through the bricks. So that's a huge problem. Third, you've got flashing around the chimney. You know, it's the metal where the chimney meets the roof. It's that metal band right there. And if that metal band around that chimney isn't sealed well, or if it's not installed correctly, water can sneak right behind it and into the attic. So water can cause all kinds of problems around a chimney. So what do we do as homeowners? You know, if we're not seeing water dripping into the attic or anything like that, do we just figure we're fine and we just wait? Or is there anything that we should be looking at? Well, there are a few things, of course, that you can look at and check out to kind of determine the health of your chimney. And first, look for white chalky stains on the brick. If you see a lot of white chalky stains on the bricks of your chimney, that's efflorescence. And that means that moisture is moving through the brick. Efflorescence is, it's basically salt deposits is what it boils down to. We talk about it inside the home, you know, and every time you see efflorescence, it just means there's a moisture issue taking place. All right. So if you see white chalky stains on the bricks, that's a bit of a warning sign. If you see spalling bricks where the faces are popping off, you know, that's a warning sign, right? That means water is causing that. Like we mentioned, the freeze-thaw cycles, water gets in, freezes, and it will start to degrade the brick. You see spalling. So look for those things. Look for cracked mortar joints or missing pieces of mortar. You know, that's something to pay attention to. Check out that crown. If it's flat, if it's cracked, if it doesn't have an overhang, all of those things are issues that you're going to want to explore further. If there's gaps in the flashing, you know, or the flashing isn't sealed well, again, that's a concern, and you should get somebody out there to take a look at that. So what do you do if you find some of these things? I can't cover everything. I will cover as much as I can in the time I'm left with. But if you've got crown issues, you know, hairline cracks or something like that, a lot of pros will come out and they'll brush on an elastomeric coating. And an elastomeric coating is just a real, it's basically a rubberized coating. It goes on like paint, but it's just really, really thick. It's stretchy, and it's for the crown, and it will seal it in and protect it. If you've got large cracks or a flat mortar-only crown, well, then you're probably looking at a rebuild. You know, have to get somebody out there to rebuild it. You know, if it doesn't have the overhang or anything like that, it's going to have to be rebuilt. And so you're going to want to get some quotes on that if you're experiencing water problems. I would for sure, if you notice those things, get an inspector out there who can look it over and give you some good advice, you know, as he's looking at exactly, or she is looking at exactly what you're dealing with. So crown issues, that's what you would do with some of those things. If you've got damaged brick or mortar, you know, spalling bricks or deteriorated joints, you're probably going to need a mason or a chimney pro out there to help you fix that. If you've got flashing problems, get a good roofer. You know, they'll come out and fix it. If you've got flashing concerns, a lot of roofing companies will come out and they'll give you a free estimate to diagnose if you do have an issue out there. Above Roofing, Sheriff Goslin Roofing, they'll all come out and do, you know, just a free inspection and give you some good info that you can run with. Waterproofing the chimney, this is something that's a really good option. It's something that you probably should be doing on a regular basis. At Repcolite, we've got a great option, All-Pro Waterproofing Sealer. It's 100% clear acrylic sealer, creates a really strong, flexible, breathable coating that deeply penetrates porous substrates like the brick. It's going to protect them, waterproof them, but still allow moisture vapor to escape. That's really important. Don't paint your chimney bricks with some kind of, you know, film-forming coating like that elastomeric. That elastomeric I mentioned is for the crown only. Don't be painting anything up there without consulting an expert. So if you've got issues or concerns about your chimney, talk to the right people. And if you're thinking that you'd like to get a waterproofer on those bricks as a good preventative maintenance project, stop out at your nearest Repcolite store, tell us what you're working on, you know, what you got going, and we'll walk you through everything you need to know to make sure you do it right. And like I said, don't seal those bricks with anything without talking about it first, with some experts. Not just talking about it, talk about it with some experts. Stop out at a store at a Repcolite and talk to us about it, because using the wrong product on those bricks can actually potentially make the situation worse. So don't do that. Talk to us. We'll help you do it right. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home in Progress. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider subscribing to the show. Please consider leaving a review, unless it's a really bad one. then you can, you know, consider leaving a review, but I'd encourage you not to, in the end, decide to leave a review. If it's a good review, a positive review, a glowing review, by all means, leave one or 12. I don't even care. Make sure you share the show with your friends and all of that stuff. I've got links to some of the resources that I mentioned in this episode. I've got links in the show notes, so check those out. I'm pretty much rambling right now, so I'm going to wrap it up. For Home in Progress, I'm Dan Hansen. Thanks for listening.